Mrs. Rowan seems to believe otherwise every time she goes to Harrods. I can tell you I do not have a press in the cellar.
Maisie laughed, along with her late husband's father, and reiterated that she would indeed find that list of airfields useful. In the meantime, she asked if he might know the nearest RAF station to Whitchurch.
Oh, there's a few. Let me think. Middle and Nether Wallop aren't far away. Though Middle Wallop is for the training of new pilots. Perhaps your friend's son will be sent there soon. Probably you'd want to go to Andover. Again, it's mainly used for training, and they have a couple of bomber squadrons there and a maintenance division. Yes, I would imagine Andover would be high on the list for any fire retardant work.
As the pips sounded to indicate more coins were needed, she heard Lord Julian call out,
"Mustache now, Maisie!"
And he was gone. She exited the telephone kiosk and stood for some moments, thinking. How could she ever find the painting crew? They could be anywhere in the county. They could even have moved on to Dorset. So she would have to return to make a concerted effort to find Joe Coombs. Indeed, he might have already been in touch with his parents once more. She was about to step toward the Alvis when she stopped, turned around, and entered the telephone kiosk again. She had managed to obtain more change from Mrs. Keep that morning, but calls to London were not cheap. The next call, however, might cost her nothing if it were accepted. She picked up the telephone receiver and dialed the operator.
"I'd like to place a reverse charge call, please," said Maisie. "To Whitehall, 1212. Tell them it's Maisie Dobbs calling, urgently, for Detective Chief Inspector Cordwell."
She waited, nibbling at a hangnail on her little finger. She could hear the conversation back and forth between the operator and her counterpart at Scotland Yard, and then waited until she heard a familiar voice.
"Tell her I'll accept the bloody charges, though I'll live to regret it, knowing that one."
"Caldwell," said Maisie.
"All right. What is it?"
Caldwell was brusque, but Maisie could hear something else in his voice, as if he were smiling, enjoying a certain pleasure in the fact that she had called him, and it could only be because she needed his assistance.
"Hello, Detective Chief Inspector. I wonder if you could give me a hand with something?"
"I've already helped you out with the price of this call. Now what?"
"I'm much obliged to you for your generosity, Inspector, but I wonder if you would be so kind as to call whoever is your main liaison person in Hampshire, in the police force. I'm investigating the case of a London boy who's been working in these parts but hasn't been in touch with his parents for a while, and..."
"Oh, blamin' heck. You want me to ask Spud Murphy down there in Basingstoke if he's been nannying a boy lately?"
"Not quite. I want to know if... well, I want to know if the remains of a 15-year-old lad, mousy hair, about 5 feet 9 inches, freckles on his nose, medium build, no other distinguishing marks that I know of, has been found and not been identified."
"What makes you think the boy could be dead?"
Maisie felt a shiver of sensation as if someone had run an icicle across her neck. "I just want to rule it out as a possibility."
"And where can I get a hold of you, your ladyship?"
She sighed. Caldwell could never resist any chance to get under her skin. "I'm returning to London today. I would hope to be there by late afternoon, all being well, but if I can, I'll stop somewhere and call in from a kiosk. Plans might change, after all."
"Make sure you've got some money on you next time, won't you?"
"Thank you, Inspector Caldwell."
Maisie replaced the telephone receiver and left the kiosk. She climbed into the Alvis, and after consulting the map and the number of motor spirit coupons she had with her, she set off. She hoped to find someone who not only knew where the Yates crew were going next, but also would be prepared to tell her. There was an element of being in another part of the country that Maisie enjoyed. Driving along main roads and country lanes, she looked out at the landscape beyond at the way fields were laid out that was different from the Kentish farmland she knew so well. Passing through villages and hamlets, she compared houses of stone and slate with the weatherboard cottages lining the main thoroughfare through the village of Chelstone, or the brick terrace houses of the railway towns she looked out upon during her train journeys to and from London. Soon she was approaching Andover, and took little time in locating the airfield. As she expected, her first stop, perhaps her only stop, was the guardhouse, where she was asked to state her business by a military policeman, who came out to discover the purpose of her visit.
"I wonder if you might be able to help me," said Maisie. "I'm looking for someone who can tell me if the painting crew is still here at Andover, or even in the area, if they've moved on. You probably saw them from Yates and Sons in London. They're applying a fire retardant to the buildings. My friend's son is among them. He's a young apprentice, and they fear he's ill and needs to return to his home."
She passed a calling card and her identity card through the open window of the Elvis. The guard flipped from one card to the next. "As you can see," added Maisie, "I'm an investigator, and as I was in the area on a personal matter, I said I would try to find out how he is." The guard looked around at his fellow serviceman, who was now standing outside the guardhouse.
"Call the ops room. Ask Captain Michaels if he can come down, would you? Unexpected visitor. Civilian."
"Oh, and if you would like additional confirmation of my identity, you can call Detective Chief Inspector Caldwell of Scotland Yard."
"Just pull over there, Miss Dobbs. You won't have to wait long."
5 minutes later, a motorbike approached the other side of the gate, its rider clad in a leather jacket over a distinctive blue-grey uniform. He cut the engine, removed the leather jacket, pulled a cap from a pannier at the side of his motorbike, and approached the guard. Maisie saw the guard pass her identity and calling cards to the officer, who seemed to raise an eyebrow as he looked at Maisie, and, she thought, made some sort of joke when he turned back to the men, as the two guards laughed in response. He stepped across to her motor car.
"Miss Dobbs! Captain Michaels!"
He touched his cap by way of greeting.
"You're interested in the painting crews?"
"Crews? I am only interested in one crew, as you probably know. They're working at airfields around the country, applying a type of fire retardant. It has quite a distinctive, unpleasant odour, so I am sure if they've been here, you would have smelled it in every room."
He nodded, studying her calling card and identity card again.
"I told the guard you can place a call to Scotland Yard if you..."
Michaels, who Maisie estimated to be a good 6 feet tall, leaned toward the window, resting his right hand on the roof of the Elvis.
"That won't be necessary. Your possible arrival here is already noted and clearance given to allow you to enter. Friends in high places, eh?"
His look was one of amused disdain. "If you have already received clearance for me, then I suppose I do have friends in the right places, though I certainly didn't request such favouritism."
"Well, there's not much to tell you, Miss Dobbs, or I'd ask you into the mess for a chat. Yes, we've had painting crews, some working on the outside and some working on the interiors of the buildings. They've moved on now, and I think they're over at our decoy site, but of course, now I've told you that, if I find out you're an enemy agent after all, I'll have to kill you."
There was a second's delay before he grinned.
"Oh, I don't think you need to go that far," said Maisie, smiling in return. "But what's a decoy site?"
"It's fake. Everything about it is fake. Fake buildings, fake aircraft, fake people. No, just kidding about the people. But from the air it looks like a place of substance and will draw enemy aircraft away from Andover. We've a lot going on here. I'm sure you know that."
"And where is the decoy?"
"Hurstbourne, Tarrant. Mind you, by the time you get there, the painters could have moved on again. That one would have been faster to go over, and perhaps not so crucial. After all, if the enemy bombed the place, we wanted to look like they scored a good one with lots of fire and flames, anything to keep them away from here."
Right. I'll go over there. The officer shrugged.
You've got the clearance.
Maisie nodded and held out her hand. Do you fly, Captain?
Oh, yes. Just doing a spot of desk duty today. Had a thumper of a headache this morning, so I had to go to the sick bay, but I'll be back in the air later. I'm on Blenheim's.
And you're going into France? The young man tapped the side of his nose and smiled.
Can't say. Even you don't have clearance for that.
And at that moment, Maisie knew this officer, who seemed far too young for such a job, would be bound for France, and with his squadron would be doing all he could to press back the German army, who were fast approaching the beaches where soldiers were beginning to gather. Without thinking, she placed her hand on the top of his arm. Safe landings, Captain. I wish you safe landings.
Much obliged, Miss Dobbs. Now then, must be getting on.
And with that, he returned to his motorbike, removed his cap, and pushed it down into the pannier, and pulled on his leather jacket once more, though he did not fasten it. Maisie watched as he turned the bike, and made off in the direction of the airfield buildings at speed, his jacket flapping out the wind like a pair of wings.
All right, miss, said the guard.
Yes, thank you. Could you give me directions to Hurstbourne Terrant? There were two guards on duty at the decoy airfield. They checked her identity card and informed her that they had been briefed regarding her inquiry, and that a small painting crew was indeed at the airfield. Someone would be across to speak to her in about 5 minutes. As she waited, it occurred to Maisie that a decoy airfield was like any other RAF station, except for the silence and the lack of activity. It was as if she were looking at an empty shell discarded on the beach. 20 minutes later, an approaching white dot in the distance revealed itself to be a van from Yates Yard in London. When it screeched to a halt a few yards away from the gate, a man of about 30 years of age emerged from the vehicle dressed in white overalls. His pale blue shirt was visible above the collar, and he wore paint-splattered hobnail boots. He reached back into the van for a cloth and was wiping his hands as he approached Maisie.
Miss Dobbs?
Yes. That's me.
Freddy Mays, foreman on this job here. What can I do for you? I understand you're looking for young Joey Coombs.
Yes, that's right. Have you seen him? The man shook his head.
Not for a few days. He was called off to work with another crew. Trouble is, I heard he'd gone home, back to London.
Gone home? When?
The man ran his fingers through dark hair swept back with brilliantine, and then absently wiped his fingers against his overalls.
About 4 days ago, I reckon. Couldn't stand the job, all the travelling around, not sleeping in his own bed of a night.
He inspected his paint-stained hands.
He told me he wasn't feeling right. And I told him, don't be a silly lad, before he knows it, he'll be 17 and up for conscription, and then he'll know what getting fed up with being away from home is really like. I said to him, stay with the crew, boy. You're in a reserved occupation working on these airfields. You'll go through this war safe as houses and not end up looking down at where your legs used to be and wondering how that came to happen. I told him what my dad was like when he came home from France. I was going on 5 years of age and I remember screaming all night, not being able to walk properly ever again. And then there was his lungs. Soon as this job came up, I was in. After all this war business, I'm going back to my street, and with all the bits of my body where they should be.
So, as far as you know, he went back and should be at home, reiterated Maisie.
Haven't heard from him since he told me he'd had enough. To be honest, I think being the youngest was a bit much for him, because he's the only apprentice on the crew.
Maisie nodded agreement. Yes, that would do it for a sensitive boy.
Sensitive? Joey Coombs? Oh, let me tell you, that boy could have his moments. Probably had, too, some of the company he was keeping.
What do you mean? The Joe I know is a good lad.
Yeah, but you know what they say. It's the quiet ones you've got to watch.
He gave a snorting half-laugh, dismissive in tone, and
pulled a pack of woodbines from the top pocket of his overalls.
"Can't have a smoke around here, you know, not when we're working."
He continued as he lit up and drew on the cigarette, holding it between thumb and forefinger, then inspecting the ashen glow as he exhaled smoke away from Maisie.
"Couple of lads, older than Joe, I reckon, came down to see him. Said they were looking up their old friend, and when I told them he had work to do, they got all stroppy. Joe went out and had a word, and off they went. Looked like a pair of hounds to me. Old enough to be in uniform, but in civvies. I asked him who they were, and he just said mates. But I had a feeling he was well in with them, though. Not that I can put a finger on why."
The man looked away from Maisie before she could speak and called over to the guardsman.
"What's the time, mate?"
"Not your knocking-off time yet, old son," came the reply.
A second's laughter ensued, and Freddie Mays turned back to Maisie.
"Better be off now, miss. Work to do, and there's a lot of it."
"Are you doing well out of it?" asked Maisie.
"Earning more than we were getting for touching up mansions in Belgravia for snooty women who wanted us to match the paint with the curtains of their frocks. And on this job, Joe is getting a good wad of cash in his pay packet for an apprentice. Shame he couldn't take it. He was good at his work. Very precise. Had good hands on him. Worker's hands."
"Then off he goes, home to his mum."
Maisie thanked the man, ignoring the tone in his voice. She had no further questions but watched as he walked to the van, throttled the engine into life and drove at speed back to the decoy airfield, toward empty buildings that reminded Maisie of a still body bereft of a beating human heart. Chapter 5. The black motor car visible in Maisie's rear-view mirror was not close enough to be overly obvious, but it had been in her wake a little too long for her not to have noticed. The driver had signalled when she had braked when she had, and had remained well back when she slowed her speed. Now she would test the driver. She would not return to London. Instead, she would detour across country, through Petersfield and onward beyond Petworth, taking the road onto Uckfield, and then Heathfield across to Tunbridge Wells, and finally, Chelstone. It would be a rare coincidence if a fellow driver were to be undertaking the long, identical journey. For her part, London could wait. She would go to see Anna, and along the way find out if she were being followed. It was close to Heathfield that Maisie looked into the mirror and saw only a green Morris 8 trailing behind her. She had first spotted it pulling out of a petrol station some 2 miles away. She breathed a sigh of relief, feeling the tension she had held in her neck ebb away. Already somewhat lighter, she decided to stop in Tunbridge Wells to buy a gift for Anna. Not a doll. Anna was not drawn to dolls, much preferring the company of the giant Alsatian Emma, or her white pony, Lady. She enjoyed reading, so a book might be a good choice, a story they could read together. But Maisie had to take care and not spend a lot of money. It must be a gift without obvious high value, or she would be taken to task by her father. Frankie Dobbs had never hidden his concern regarding the bond that had grown between Maisie and the evacuee child. Maisie parked close to the picturesque area known as the Panteels, walked to the bookshop opposite the bandstand and chose an illustrated edition of The Railway Children by E. Nesbitt. Leaving the shop with her brown paper-wrapped parcel, she realized she was anxious to reach Chelstone, and she thought then about how Joe might have felt, far from home, moving from place to place with the painting crew. Such dislocation might well have caused distress, leading to tension, and subsequently headaches. She unlocked the door of the Alvis, placed her shoulder bag and the small parcel on the passenger seat, and, having started the engine, was about to maneuver out onto the main thoroughfare when she saw a black motor car idling across the road. The driver's face was obscured by a newspaper, but as she watched, the corner flapped down, and the man behind the wheel stole a look at her vehicle. He brought up the newspaper with a sharp snap. Maisie held her breath, but moved off after another motor car had passed, and then turned right, followed by an immediate left. She pulled into a narrow lane of terrace houses to the right of a church on the corner, stopped the vehicle beyond a tree, and looked back at the road she had just left. Only a few seconds elapsed before the black motor car passed by. If she emerged from the lane now, the driver might spot her in his rearview mirror, but at the same time she did not want to give him time to turn around and come in search of her. She slammed the gear into reverse, pulled back onto the road, and proceeded in the direction of the Pantiles. Beyond the shops was an area of rough ground surrounded by trees. She would wait there a while before making her way to Tunbridge, and then to Chilstone. And during the time spent sitting under the broad canopy of a plane tree, she had time to speculate. Who was following her? What nerve had she touched in her investigation thus far into the whereabouts of Joe Coombs? She could not imagine the landlady in Whitchurch having given her name to another person. But perhaps someone came along with a few choice banknotes and was soon in possession of Maisie's card. Given the time of day and the encroaching evening, it would have been clear she was staying locally, so the driver had only to wait until the following day to identify her motor car as she drove through Whitchurch, and then wait for her at each stop until she was on her way back to London. Or could Billy's visit to Yates's yard have sparked interest? Perhaps he'd asked one question too many and had set off an alarm, and now Maisie was being followed. But by whom? A government agent? A Yates employee? Someone from the military department supplying Yates with what could well be a toxic paint. Another hour passed before Maisie felt a sufficient level of ease to drive off through Tunbridge Wells, skirting around Tunbridge in the direction of Chilstone, where she arrived late afternoon. When Maisie entered through the kitchen door, Brenda informed her that Anna was asleep in her room, guarded by the ever-watchful Emma. "How is she?" asked Maisie, as her stepmother busied herself making a chicken broth.
"Had a bit of a temperature today, but the fever broke last night, and she's full of spots, poor little mite. I put a pair of cotton gloves on her hands, stops her doing too much damage to her skin if she scratches in her sleep. She has conjunctivitis, so I go in and bathe her eyes of a morning. She smiled this morning and said she liked feeling the warm water. So, now we've got to get some good bone broth down here. And she does like chicken, so cook over at the house sent a girl round this morning with one already cooked. She said it was roasted last night for the Canadians, but they preferred the beef. Well, they would, wouldn't they? Strapping great men like that. What with all them prairies, or whatever it is they have over there.
I'll go up to see her now, said Maisie. I can only stay tonight. I have a lot of work on my plate at the moment, but I'll be back on Thursday. Maisie removed her jacket and slipped it over the back of a kitchen chair. She took the wrapped book and made her way upstairs. Anna was curled up in her bed, her hands clasped under her chin. Her eyes were closed, but the way Emma, lying down alongside the bed, was looking up at her young mistress, Maisie guessed that Anna was not asleep. She stroked the dog's head and knelt by the bed. She placed her hand on the child's forehead and, without thinking, leaned forward to kiss the place where her fingers had just measured the girl's temperature.
"Auntie Maisie!"
Anna's voice was little more than a whisper.
"Oh, pet, you poor little mite." "I'm all right, Miss Maisie. Emma's here, and Auntie Brenda says she'll let me have my broth from the pudding basin. Nan always gave me broth in the pudding basin if I wasn't feeling well."
"You can have your broth in whatever bowl you want, Anna." She ran her fingers across the little girl's forehead again.
"I have a present for you. A new book."
Anna nodded. Maisie set the book down as Brenda came into the room, bearing a tray with a small white pudding basin filled with broth, a slice of fresh bread, and a glass of Lucozade.
"There you are. Anna could do with the extra glucose and the Lucozade," said Brenda. "It'll give her more energy to get better."
Maisie helped Anna to sit up and put her arm around her as Brenda set the tray on the bed. It was as Maisie dipped the spoon into the broth and held it steady for Anna to sip that she was aware of Brenda watching her. She looked up. "What is it?" Brenda seemed to purse her lips and shook her head.
"Nothing. Not now, anyway."
She left the room, and Maisie continued to guide the spoon until Anna reached for it and insisted upon eating without help. When the child had taken all she could, and her eyes had become heavy again, Maisie made her comfortable, watched her drift into sleep, and brought the tray back down to the kitchen. I took her to the lavatory, so she's settled now. Maisie took the basin and cutlery from the tray and began to wash them at the sink. "I'm concerned. Is something else wrong with Anna, Brenda? What's going on?"
"I reckon the child needs to know where she stands, Maisie. Makes a body weaker, not knowing your place in the world."
"She's here with us, and she's safe."
"But what about when this is all over? This war? Then what? You may have her best interests at heart, and you may now have some sort of power of attorney, or whatever they call it, but I bet she wonders where she'll fetch up when all the children go home."
"She'll always have a place here, you know that, until we find a family for her."
"And that's the rub, isn't it, Maisie? It's one thing you explaining things, but I reckon something should be done about it. Now, before she gets too settled here, we all love her. How could we not? But you promised to make sure she had a good home. What do you think you can do about it?"
Maisie nodded. "I'll talk to Mr. Klein. He'll know what to do next."
"Good."
Brenda picked up a cloth to dry the crockery and cutlery Maisie had just washed.
"And your friend, Priscilla, she phoned to confirm that Tim is going to come down to Chelston on Saturday. He's had another falling out at home, and he apparently said that he wanted to see Tante Maisie because she was the only one who understood him. His mother told him you would be busy until Saturday anyway, and he was not to bother you any sooner." "Oh, dear. Poor Pris."
"Poor Tim, if you ask me. Mind you, he has got a mouth on him when he likes."
"It's just his age. He'll grow out of it, Brenda. Did she say what train he was catching?"
"She said she would put him on the train from London, so he can change at Tonbridge for the 11 o'clock stopping train down to Chelstone."
Maisie sighed. "He's such a good boy, good young man, really. He just hates the fact that Tom appears to be proving himself to be a man, and he hasn't had the chance yet.
He probably wants to run away, but not too far, and you two do get on, don't you?"
"That's because I'm not his mother. Anyway, let's get Dad to line up some jobs for him. And it'll cheer up Anna no end to have him here. She has a little girl crush on him." The telephone woke Maisie at 6:30 in the morning. At first, its ringing came as part of a dream, a sound in the distance along a tunnel where she was searching for something. She did not know what it was that was lost, but in the dream her anxiety increased until she awoke, her heart pounding. "Hello?" In her half-sleep, Maisie could not remember the number to recite to the caller.
"Miss Dobbs, still having sweet dreams, are you?"
"Good morning, Inspector. Isn't this rather early for you?"
"Early when there's work to be done, and you know what they say about the early bird."
"What is it, Inspector Caldwell?"
"Your boy, one Joseph Coombs, fits the description of a body found yesterday at..."
Maisie heard Caldwell pause and the sound of a sheet of paper being turned.
"Basingstoke Railway Station. Some trauma to the noddle, but according to Inspector Murphy, it could have happened when he fell. Sounds nasty, though."
"But..."
"Haven't finished yet," said Caldwell. "We need an identification, and of course there's notification of the deceased's nearest and dearest. You know the boy, so you could identify the body. In the circumstances, it might be best to save the mum and dad the grief, if you know what I mean. It's not a pretty sight, and the better part of me, you'll be pleased to know I have one, would like to save them the last memory of their son. How do you want to proceed?"
Maisie had come to her feet as Caldwell was speaking, and pulled a dressing gown around her shoulders.
How do I want to proceed? I thought you'd just told me how I was proceeding. I'll go back to Hampshire and then up to London.
I've already sent a motor car to take you down there. Save your coupons, we've got plenty. For now, anyway. By the time you've had your toast and marmalade, the motor will be outside your door. Murphy's waiting for you in Basingstoke, all right?
Yes, of course, said Maisie, rubbing the scar on her neck. Poor Joe.
Poor Joe? He's out of it now. It's his poor mum and dad, that's what's poor. And you and I should have a chinwag. The yard's involved, which means me, and we both know I don't exactly have a lot of minutes in the day to spare, not with being short on staff. Never thought I'd see the day when I missed Abel. But my able assistant Abel is now able seaman Abel, left just after that business with the Belgian refugees last year. Apparently he's been posted to HMS Keith. Name like his. I bet he takes a lot of ribbing.
Maisie sighed, remembering the polite detective constable and the stoic manner with which he tolerated Caldwell's insistent jokes about his name. And not very funny jokes, in her estimation. You didn't exactly give him an easy time. I would bet he wins the respect of his fellow men. You wait and see.
And I am sure I will. Wait, that is. Right. When you're finished in Basingstoke, the motor car will bring you back to London, and we can go together to see the parents. No good me bothering them before that, just in case it's not him. I'll get you a travel warrant to come back to Kent, so you don't have to pay.
Thank you, Inspector.
Oh, and your ladyship? I take it your little investigation will be coming to an end now?
I'm sorry, Inspector. There's some interference on the line. I can't hear you very well. Hello?
Hello. I'll expect the motor car in a short while, then. Goodbye.
She heard Caldwell offer a muffled expletive as she returned the receiver to its cradle. The journey to Basingstoke offered an opportunity to think about Joe Coombs, and more importantly, the precious little she had uncovered thus far. She knew that in such circumstances it was all too easy to assign importance to discoveries that were insignificant, but at the same time every stone was worthy of a turn. And if there was nothing untoward in Joe's death, if indeed she was able to make a positive identification, why had she been followed from Whitchurch to Tunbridge Wells? For there was no doubt in her mind that the black motor car had been on her tail since she left Hampshire, and might well have followed her from London. But was the driver interested due to her questioning of Joe's whereabouts, or was it in connection with Billy's visit to Yates's yard? Then another thought came back to her. Might the man following her have been a spy? The police driver said little to Maisie, apart from the occasional inquiry as to whether she might require a break, a refreshment stop, perhaps. But there was something about the journey that reminded her of her flight from Gibraltar into Spain, when she travelled alone with the driver who ferried her to the makeshift field hospital, where she became a nurse once again. She felt the weight of remembrance bear down upon her as she recalled the young men and sometimes women who were brought to the former convent, often under cover of darkness to have their injuries tended. In those days she became both doctor and nurse, and she saw, again, the wounds of battle. Joe, with his headaches, was now a victim of a new war. And who would be the other new victims? Yet still there would be the Tims of the world, aching to get to where the action might be, desperate to prove themselves. She remembered then a saying that someone had quoted to her once. Was it her father? It certainly wasn't Maurice, because she had heard it spoken by a Yorkshireman. Someone from northern England, of that she was sure.
There, there's muck, there's brass.
That was it. Was it Joseph Waite, the self-made man who had hired her to find his daughter years ago? It had been one of her first cases after Maurice retired. Yes, perhaps it was him. Where there's muck, there's brass. A simple line, an aphorism that seemed to suggest the selling of manure. But it had a meaning that went so much deeper, alluding to the fact that where you find filth, where you find dirt, where you find the detritus of life, you'll also discover someone making a profit.
Much money can be made from the most dirty jobs. Muck and money go together. That was another one. And it occurred to her that in her lifetime she had seen nothing more filthy than war itself.
"Oh, you're in the money, then,"
Lord Julian had said during their telephone conversation. It was a quip, a joke, but two things now came to mind. One, Joe Coombs was working in close proximity to the country's source of wealth, and secondly, that Yates had accepted a lucrative contract that was potentially harmful to his workers. It wouldn't be the first time she had seen the hardest working people become enmeshed in a web not of their own making. "There's a reason they call it filthy lucre, Maisie." Maurice's words, spoken in the early days of her own apprenticeship, echoed in her mind. It was almost as if he were by her side, pushing, testing, guiding her. Detective Chief Inspector Spud Murphy was a jovial man, and, Maisie thought, seemed as if he would be more suited to life as a village butcher. She could imagine him wearing a white cotton coat, a blue-striped apron and a straw boater, his drooping jowls held in place by a starched white collar and blue bow tie. Yet, at the same time, it was clear, once he had introduced himself, that Murphy was efficient and businesslike, and she could not envision him wielding a cleaver.
"Caldwell said you were held in high regard by his department, Miss Dobbs," said Murphy,
opening a folder presented to him by the driver who had brought Maisie to Basingstoke.
"He did,"
said Maisie, her brow furrowed, though she smiled. After all, she and Caldwell were not what Lady Rowan would have called pally. Murphy grinned in return.
"Mind you, he also said not to tell you, but I thought I would. Not a nice business, this. Helps to have something positive in your back pocket to fall back on if your day includes identification of the dead."
"May I see the post-mortem report first?" asked Maisie. Murphy had placed a pair of half-moon glasses on his nose to review the contents of the folder he had just opened, and now studied her over the rims.
"You can, because Inspector Caldwell obviously trusts you. But do you understand medical notes?"
"I was a nurse in the last war, and I've studied legal medicine in Edinburgh." Murphy looked down at his notes.
"Oh, yes. And you were once assistant to Dr. Maurice Blanche, I remember now."
He closed the folder and put it to one side, picking up another that was already on his desk. He looked up at Maisie.
"Met the man a couple of times when I was at the yard, before I came down here for a quieter life. Impressive, very impressive."
He held out the folder to Maisie and consulted his watch.
"Here, have a quick gander at that. It'll prepare you."
Maisie opened the folder and began to read. "I don't think this type of injury is sustained falling off a wall, do you?" Murphy turned away from his desk to look out the window. Expanding his view, thought Maisie. It had always interested her that physically gazing out at a landscape, even if that landscape offered a cluster of town buildings, could provide a broader view of the possibilities inspired by question. She did the same thing herself when something troubled her.
"On the face of it, yes, he fell straight down onto a railway line. Fortunately, it was not a main line, but an old shunting line not used in donkey's years. If it had been another line, the skull would have been smashed beyond all recognition by a loco. So, you can see, where his noddle hit the cast iron, he sustained a very, very nasty wound."
"There's something you're not happy about, Inspector." Murphy sighed, but remained silent against sunlight emerging from behind a cloud, the beam slanting through the window. Maisie continued. "I think you might be in two minds. On the one hand, yes, it seems from this report the victim, on account of his own stupidity or a crime, fell from a high wall and straight down onto the line. However, at the same time, we could speculate that he was running from someone and stumbled from the wall in a panic. Or he could have been pushed.
Or someone could have clobbered him on the head with a very, very heavy object, and then the body was moved from somewhere else.
Murphy turned as he finished the sentence for her, and moved away from the window. Have you had soil particles tested? Was there any residue of decomposed vegetation on his clothing? Maisie ran her finger down the report.
That's right there.
Murphy stood beside her and pointed to a paragraph near the foot of the fourth page.
The railway line had to some extent returned to nature. There were weeds growing between the sleepers and among the rocks underneath, and apart from some gravel in the wound, there wasn't anything to prove movement of the body, such as mineral or plant matter from another location. I think that's what you're getting at, isn't it?
He consulted his watch.
I won't rule it out, though, but there are those who would. Come on, better get going.
Maisie could bear the smell of a pathologist's domain far better than most. She had known grown men, policemen with broad shoulders and a constitution that allowed them to face criminals armed with deadly weapons, fall to the ground upon entering a laboratory where post-mortems were conducted. Seeing a murder victim in the place where the body was found was one thing. They could steel themselves for the discovery. But there was something about the vulnerable nakedness of a corpse, having endured the attentions of a man with a scalpel, a doctor who had used sharp instruments to cut into the flesh, bone, and sinew, that could take the same policeman down in seconds. For Maisie, there was something else that kept her standing. The fact that this moment, this very personal procedure of discovery, afforded her a chance to show compassion for the dead. Maurice had taught her that in the laboratory it was all too easy to forget respect when there was nothing but the shell of a human being before you. Think of a dead body as if you are viewing a set of clothing, Maisie, but consider it as the attire the soul has worn for many a year, and it is clothing that has something to teach us about the man or woman under the knife. Without doubt, she was looking at the body of Joe Coombs. Murphy stood to one side, as an assistant informed them. Dr. Clark would be with them shortly. "It's Joe," said Maisie, looking down at the body. She glanced only briefly at the incisions where the pathologist had cut the flesh, and brought her full attention to the deep open wound on the skull. So invasive it had allowed Dr. Clark to remove tissue from the brain. She looked closer and frowned.
"What is it?"
Murphy was standing well back, halfway to the door, yet he had been watching her every move.
"She's seen what I saw. Isn't that so, Miss Dobbs?"
Maisie looked up to see a woman entering via the double doors leading into the mortuary. She stopped alongside Murphy and held out her hand.
"Spud, I take it you're well?"
Murphy opened his mouth to respond, but already the woman had moved to stand alongside Maisie. She extended her hand.
"Clarissa Clark, pathologist round here?"
The two women shook hands, and Clark pulled a pair of clean rubber gloves from her pocket before reaching toward a trolley set up with an array of surgical instruments. She snapped on the gloves, picked up a scalpel, and leaned back toward the corpse, using the instrument to indicate a small area in Joe Coombs's brain.
"That's what you're looking at, isn't it?"
"Yes," said Maisie, taking a step to the side to provide more space for Clark to move. "It looks like some sort of tumor, yet it's not, and there is no identifiable outline or margin, and the color, though... Admittedly, we are looking at a young man, deceased for some days, but still," she looked at Clark. "What do you think?" Clark sighed.
"For the purposes of this investigation, I am obviously looking at immediate cause of death. Given where he was found, I would say that yes, it's of course possible that this injury here, on the other side, was caused by falling from a height and hitting a cast-iron railway line at just the right angle."
Again, Using the scalpel, she pointed to a deep wound, a smashed orbital bone, and torn flesh above the ear, revealing a skull crushed into livid brain matter.
Very bad luck indeed.
Could it have been made worse by being pushed, therefore increasing velocity?
Yes, I would say so. But at the same time, the injury that killed Joe could well have been done by something heavy, a crowbar, for example, especially if it came down from a height.
She lifted her hand above her head and simulated bringing it down, stopping the trajectory of her hand just an inch from the open skull of Joe Coombs. But you've obviously thought about that too. Maisie gestured toward the naked brain matter that had first attracted her attention.
I have, and I have never seen anything like it.
Clark corrected herself.
No, I tell a lie. I've seen something like it in Serbia, in the last war. I was working at a field hospital, and I saw something similar to this discoloration in soldiers subject to attack by poison gases.
It's caused by exposure to toxins, isn't it?
Clark looked at Maisie. Yes, I would say you're right, in my humble opinion.
Maisie nodded, now pointing to the wound. Where this young man is concerned, if you had to make a choice between falling from a height and being attacked with a crowbar, which side would you come down on? Clark sighed.
I think you probably have an opinion, Miss Dobbs, if you are half the woman that Dr. Blanche would have taken on as his assistant.
You knew him? Maisie turned to look at Clark.
He was my favourite professor when he came to lecture during my student years.
Maisie looked down at Joe Coombs, at rest, free of pain. She closed her eyes for several seconds, and then opened them again. She looked across toward Murphy, and then at Dr. Clark. I would say he was the victim of a vicious attack, and with a heavy cast-iron object, but of course I could be wrong. As they left the mortuary together, Murphy leaned toward Maisie, as if to share a confidence.
She lied about one thing in there.
Yes, I know, replied Maisie.
That woman has never had a humble opinion in her life.
Maisie laughed, and for a moment she thought poor young Joe Coombs would have laughed at that one too, for she had felt his presence so keenly. Chapter 6 Maisie and Detective Inspector Caldwell had, for the most part, a professional association that was respectful, though at times tense. During the occasions when they worked together, she felt it was as if there were two hot electrical wires running side by side. If they came too close, there would be sparks. But over the years, they had reached a point where they could avoid a fire, and had come to hold a grudging respect for one another. And on this evening, as they departed the pub where they had just broken the news of Joe's death, to Phil and Sally Coombs, Maisie knew that Caldwell had been glad to have her at his side, and appreciated her company.
That in there, is the very worst part of this job. It's like being in a mortuary, but instead of watching someone else take the insides out of a person, you're the one doing it to the living. I feel as if I've just ripped three people apart, and there'll be one more when their other son gets home.
You did very well, Inspector Caldwell. It's not easy to tell people that someone they love has died, especially in these circumstances, said Maisie.
You did most of the telling. I just filled in the police details,
said Caldwell. But you gave them hope that you would find out what happened. I know your hands were tied, that you could not come out and admit it was murder, when there is still a question mark over the cause of death. They believe that Joe will not be forgotten, that his screams will not have fallen into a silent void, and there's a bitter comfort in that knowing. Caldwell nodded, sighing.
Offer you a lift, Miss Dobbs?
I think I'll go to my office and then get a taxi cab home. I have some work to do. Caldwell stopped alongside the dark blue motor car parked next to the pub, where the doors were still locked, and a closed sign remained in place. A police driver held the vehicle's door open, ready for his superior to step inside. The detective inspector turned to Maisie.
I won't stop you, you know, investigating the death of Joe Coombs. Just keep in touch, and I'll do the same for you. I reckon you might have more luck than me. I've a lot on my plate, and the results of the post-mortem are what they call inconclusive. So I dare say the coroner will report this one as death by misadventure, because murder can't be proven, and for all the world it looks like a risky jump on the part of the deceased, who launched himself off a wall the height of a building just for the sheer thrill and hijinks of it.
But we know that hijinks is not something someone does alone, even a boy at that age. Joe wasn't that sort of person, anyway.
And there's them who would say that any lad of 15 or 16 is a hijinks sort of person.
Caldwell touched the brim of his hat and turned to step inside the vehicle.
I'll send a motor car around in an hour to take you home. You'll never get a cab in the blackout. Be in touch, Miss Dobbs. And watch your back. I don't like this one.
Maisie raised her hand as the motor car pulled away from the curb and commenced walking toward her office in Fitzroy Square. It was dark now, so she switched on the light before running up the stairs, then turned it off as she placed her key in the lock. The last thing she wanted was an ARP man admonishing her for breaking the blackout. She could hear music coming from the top floor. Having once been servants' quarters in the days when the mansion had been a private home, the upper floor had been divided into separate bed-sitting rooms and were let to students from the Slade Art Institute. There was no noise from the flats during the day, but at night there was often a gramophone playing, or the sound of voices, and sometimes even hijinks. She had not intended to remain in the office long, but she was grateful to Caldwell and his offer of a vehicle to take her home. She unlocked the door and felt her way to the windows to draw the blackout curtains before stepping through to her private office, where she again drew the blackout curtains and turned on her desk light. Sandra had left a few messages for her on top of a leather-bound blotting paper book that held a letter to be signed between each leaf. Maisie flicked through the messages, stopping at one in particular. She drew the light down to read.
A woman named Sylvia Preston telephoned and said she was with the WAAF in Hampshire. Apparently she had telephoned the office a couple of times, but there was no answer, so I didn't speak to her until she tried again on Wednesday afternoon. She said she had been a lodger in the same house as Joe Coombs until he left recently, though she added that she has been sent to a new billet now. She explained that she overheard your conversation with the landlady, and she thought she should telephone, as she would like to speak to you personally. The landlady had left your card on the hall table, so she was able to obtain your telephone number. She is stationed at one of the airfields, but would not say which one. It's very difficult for her to place a call to you, given her hours. However, she said she could wait at the telephone kiosk in Whitchurch on Sunday evening at 7 o'clock.
A number was inscribed below the message. Maisie walked across to the window and fingered back the curtain just enough to look down through the grainy darkness onto the yard at the back. A sliver of light from the occupant's not-quite-closed blackout curtains illuminated the fact that nature had finally yielded to the attention of a committed tenant. She could discern the outline of a series of terracotta pots holding geraniums, pelargoniums, and hydrangeas, and since war had been declared, the tenant had begun to grow vegetables in a series of wooden boxes. It reminded Maisie that she should have done the same and started her own vegetable garden. As an island, Britain depended in part upon its merchant navy to keep the larders stocked, and that merchant navy was now at risk from U-boat attack. The people of Britain understood only too well that men were risking their lives to put food on their tables. In the newspapers and on posters, it had been made clear that if everyone took responsibility for growing some vegetables, it would help keep families fed over the long haul of war. She admonished herself for not calling earlier to speak to Sandra. Indeed, it was likely that Sandra had telephoned Chelstone to recount the messages, but had missed her. She sighed with frustration she could have learned something important from Sylvia Preston. Why else would the WAAF have made the effort to contact her? Turning away from the window, Maisie ensured the curtains met with no room for light to escape. She knew she would feel a greater control if she worked on a case map. It would give her direction and insight. Joe Coombs deserved an advocate, someone who would speak for him, someone who would seek out the source of his ill health and ultimately his death. So she set to work, taking a length of wallpaper from a basket in the corner. Billy's friend, a painter and decorator, furnished them with the ends of rolls used in his job, and they had proven perfect for the job. It was as Maisie laid out the paper, patterned side down, on a long table set perpendicular to her desk, that it occurred to her. Painter and decorator. What was Billy's friend's name? She stepped across to her desk and reached for the telephone. No, Billy would not be at home. But he might walk into Whitchurch to place a call to his younger son, just to check up on him. She began to dial. The telephone rang, and when a voice came on the line, for a moment Maisie did not know what to say, for Bobby Beale sounded just like his father. Oh, I thought you were your father for a moment, Bobby. It's Miss Dobbs here.
Hello, miss. If you're looking for Dad, he won't be back until tomorrow. I thought you knew. He's coming back, and so's Mum and Maggie Rowe.
Bobby yawned as he finished speaking. Maisie smiled. Unlike their parents, who referred to their daughter by her full name, the boys had always called her Maggie Rowe. But she was also concerned. Your mum's coming back?
She misses me. That's what it is.
Bobby laughed and continued,
Well, probably not. But she's coming back, not to stay, because it's better for them down there. But she's coming back with Dad tomorrow. I reckon he'll give me a ring soon, just to make sure I'm behaving myself.
And are you behaving yourself?
Can't do otherwise, can I? What with Mr. and Mrs. Pickering coming around, driving from all that way across the water, and telling me they were just passing, as if I don't know that petrol coupons are like gold dust. And then there's the woman next door popping in to check up on me. I keep saying I'm 16, old enough to look after myself.
Could you ask your dad to telephone me as soon as he can?
Will do.
Bobby followed his words with a deep sigh. What is it, Bobby? Are you all right?
I can come over if you like. Make you a nice dinner? I've loads of nice dinners in that fridge. By the way, did you know my dad bought a fridge? Never had one before and don't know anyone who's got one either. He said it was a surprise for my mum. Well, it will be, because it's full of pies. I wish Mrs. Ralph would bring cake. That's what I fancy.
I'll see what I can do for you.
Miss, can I ask you something?
What is it, Bobby? There was silence on the line. Bobby?
It's like this, Miss Dobbs.
You remember last year at one of your Sunday dinners I ended up talking to Tom, the one who's gone into the RAF?
Yes, I remember. I saw you were deep in conversation. He's not really what I'd call my sort or very posh, but he was nice to me and asked about what I'd do, you know, being a mechanic. I was telling him how I really like working on engines, that it's sort of like playing a musical instrument for me. Not that I can play any musical instrument, but it sounded right. I told him that I listen to the engines, that I listen for them to sort of sing. I can tell when I've got an engine right by the sound. I thought he would laugh, but instead he says, You should do an aircraft apprenticeship.
And he told me about the College for Aircraft Mechanics at RAF Halton in Buckinghamshire. He said I'm old enough to join the RAF as an apprentice. Maisie felt her heart palpitate. Oh, dear. Tom, what have you done now?
Anyway, Bobby continued, he sent me a letter with all the details and I found out how to apply. The woman in the library down the road helped me.
And you didn't tell your dad, did you?
No. I mean, what with my brother going off into the army, I didn't want to say anything. And it might have come to nothing anyway.
They've accepted you, haven't they? Asked Maisie.
Well, I had to get out of my job for 2 days, a couple of weeks ago now, to go for an interview in medical. They got me to work on an engine, too. It was really easy for me.
Dad didn't even notice I wasn't there because he was down in Hampshire.
Anyway, the letter came this morning. I'll be an RAF mechanic.
But they need your father's signature on the permission form.
Is that it?
Yes. Bobby Beale.